Good afternoon and welcome to Time Out, your program of informative interviews with persons of note, persons with fascinating careers, leaders of today and tomorrow, and others who will allow you to invest an hour and receive a guaranteed valuable return. So stay tuned. This is Bill Hendrickson, your host of Time Out, welcoming you to the show. And on a partly cloudy, partly sunny day here in Carrboro, North Carolina. But the topic of the day is going to be full of interest and I guess we'll say sunshine, because the woman we're going to be talking with has written some interesting material about a topic of fascinating interest in Durham. Her name is Laura Bache. Laura, welcome to Time Out.
Thanks so much, Bill. It's great being here.
Laura is a journalist for the Raleigh News and Observer, and you've only been there for a while.
I have. I am the Report for America core member for the News and Observer, and I started working for the NNO June last year.
A little bit about your history. Where's your childhood? Where'd you grow up?
Oh my gosh, that's the worst question you could ever ask me, Bill. I grew up between Massachusetts, outside the greater Boston area, and then also in the Dominican Republic, where my father is from. And then...
Wait, I didn't get that. After Boston was where?
The Dominican Republic, on the northern side of the island.
Oh, Dominican Republic.
Yes, sir. And then the later half of my years I spent in Winston-Salem, North Carolina.
Okay, well, the Dominican Republic is getting an awful lot of attention as the most popular island in the Caribbean.
Yes, it's definitely a beautiful place to visit. But, you know, as a journalist, I like to see both sides of things. It also has some complicated history as well. So I'm looking at both sides.
We don't need to go into all that, but I guess I did read their name in the history book when I was in high school many years ago. So then you've been here just a short time. Where were you working or living before you came to Raleigh or Chapel Hill?
Yeah, so before the News and Observer, I was the Latino and immigration reporter for WFAE in Charlotte, North Carolina. That is the NPR affiliate for the Charlotte area.
Okay. And do you speak fluent Spanish, I guess?
I do. Yes, sir.
That gives you a break on the rest of us, and it's great to have a language in the dish. I guess that's your native language, isn't it?
It is. Yes, sir. Yeah, it was the first language spoken at home.
Okay. Well, I studied German in college, and when I was in the military, I was assigned to Germany into a spy, a counterintelligence group. But I couldn't speak the German language like a street person, so I really couldn't be very effective.
It really takes being kind of in that environment all the time in order for you to learn. That's something I've learned about other languages I've tried to learn as well that aren't Spanish. Yeah.
Do you like living in this part of North Carolina?
Oh, I love North Carolina at this point. I consider myself a Tar Heel. I went to UNC Chapel Hill. My husband also went to Carolina. We're both Carolina grads. I've lived in all three, the Triangle, the Piedmont Triad, and Charlotte, all the three, you know, the three major areas. I've lived in all three at this point, and I love North Carolina. I see myself here indefinitely.
You're never going back to the Dominican Republic to live.
I don't know. Maybe once I hit that retirement age.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, you can go back and start all over again. Anyway, we have a lot to talk about, and this is the job with Hatai, I guess that's how you pronounce it, is your first job with the NNO, and it's a dramatic, challenging job. How did you get stuck with that on your first day at work?
It was really, it was one of the first stories my first week at the NNO. You know, I thought they would take it easy, but no, I had about three stories I covered just that week alone. And one of them was about Haytai. And I had never heard of Haytai before. And the irony there is that I grew up in a country that shares half an island with Haiti, which is which Haytai is named after Haiti. And that's what it's honoring. And so I started reporting on a particular project called Haytai Reborn. And that was led by Dr. Henry McCoy. He is a business professor at North Carolina Central University. And what he did was kind of envision the future of Fayette Place, this 20-acre property in the middle of Haytai, as this Black-centered hub for equity and innovation, but it would also be a place that would have, you know, affordable housing. And I want to add a side note to that, that it's not just rental housing, right? This was actual property ownership that he was envisioning for that area, and businesses that in a way honored the segregation era Haytai neighborhood and Haytai community, which was known back then as Black Wall Street, actually. And so that particular reporting of that particular project led me to more reporting of the present day Haytai and Fayette Place itself and the future of it and how the Durham Housing Authority plays a role and will play a role in the future of Fayette Place as the property's owner.
Okay. So you jumped into this. Your only job at the NNO was Haytai, Fayette Place, Haytai Reform. That was the only real job you had when you started working at this particular newspaper, right?
No, well, I came in because I cover diverse communities in general. I cover a little bit of everything all across the triangle, but this really did become a big part of my reporting. And you know, I really built a lot of relationships, informing myself and learning about the community, about the Haytai community and the history of Fayette Place through the reporting I did do about Haytai and Fayette Place. But I have enjoyed a lot, you know, reporting and covering the stories of that community and the updates that have been happening about Fayette Place in the future of it. So it's not necessarily the only thing I cover, but it has become a big portion of it.
How were you accepted by the people that you met and tried to interview and did interview? Some maybe you didn't, some maybe you tried and couldn't, but a lot of others that you did interview. How were you accepted in general?
I think, you know, most people who are not familiar with the business behind journalism, you know, the kind of the field itself from the other perspective, they tend to be a little bit hesitant about, you know, disclosing information, talking to the media, and within reason. You know, I think that it's fair to say that media outlets, we must do a better job at, you know, creating more transparency. And so I think that that was my main goal in talking to the people of the Haytai community, was making sure that they saw me as a person that they could trust, that they could really share their stories with, and that I was willing to listen. So once we got on that level, that they understood that I was there to really listen and learn about them and learn their history, learn about their community, you know, the important places that made up the business district of Haytai, important things that matter to them most in what could be the future of Haytai. I think that they became very welcoming of me and me telling their stories, particularly one woman. She's known as a Haytai elder because she's one of the last surviving members of
Anita Neville Scott.
Yes, we text, you know, she keeps in touch with me, and she's very great at, you know, keeping me in touch on updates, and I update her about any stories I'm doing. She and I have built a very trusting relationship with each other of transparency and being clear and straightforward about, you know, the expectations that I can cover, what she believes needs to be covered and what needs to be said. So, it's been great, you know, having that kind of access, the honor of having that kind of access into a community that's very untrustful of entities in power, because of the, you know, the destruction of Haiti because of the, Durham Freeway in the 1960s and 70s.
It's interesting. I think I told you in my email that my wife and I drove by there. I said, I need to see this place since I live in Durham and not too far away. So we got off with the highway at Fayetteville Street, and I wasn't quite sure how I would find this this empty area, but I turned left off of Fayetteville Street to a side street and started driving down this side street and looked at the left, and it looked like a war zone. It I couldn't believe how depressed, empty foundations of homes were there, weeds, scrambling looking trees. And it was only like a mile from downtown Durham. I mean,
yes, sir.
So close to inner city Durham. And here is this battlefield.
That's a great way to put it. I mean, I think that that's the first reaction to anyone who has maybe lived in there. I mean, like I said, I went to UNC Chapel Hill. I ventured into Durham, you know, to socialize with friends and, you know, explore the downtown area. But it's very rare that people even know that that 20-acre lot of just abandoned, you know, abandoned lot of slabs of former housing exists there, chained up, fenced up, completely forgotten. And I think that's one of the most striking, you know, things about Fayette Place is that it's so close. You can literally see the Durham skyline. If you look around, you can see the Durham skyline from Fayette Place. And it's so close to the hustle and bustle and the beauty of what is downtown Durham now. Yet there's this piece of land that's completely forgotten and used to mean so much to people, was used to be kind of the heart of the residential side of Haiti, right? And is now just, like you said, it looks like a forgotten battlefield.
Yeah, you can shoot. My wife was born in Durham. This is my second marriage, and I was from New Jersey, but we moved down here, and she remembers when the freeway was built and some of the controversy. There was some controversy about that, but not a lot, because if there'd been real controversy and real anger and animosity, they may not have put the freeway in exactly there, and they may have left some of the buildings, some of the housing, and some of the businesses survive. But they didn't. They tore through the place, and that's what we're talking about. So anybody who sees that area is going to have the same kind of reaction that both you and I have had.
Yes,
anyway, how many people did you interview in this process, just roughly?
So in the past 6 months, 6-7 months that I've been doing this, I've talked to maybe a dozen different members of the community, new and old, not just people who were there from, you know, the early days, but people who have moved there recently and have tried to live there now, about a dozen at least or so. And, you know, each of them have different connections to Haiti. Each of them have different reasons for why they're there. Right? Because it does, because of how it is still relatively affordable compared to much of Durham, right? To live in that area. Mm-hmm. But that could change depending on what it becomes. And Fayette Place could play a key role in that, right? Fayette Place could play a key role in the cost of living becoming more expensive in that area if, you know, if there were some kind of development that, that, you know, didn't honor or didn't really recognize the cost of living there right now and what kind of financials people are experiencing in that area.
Well, so driving down Fayetteville Street toward the university, is most of the housing and most of the small businesses that are still there are black people living in most of the houses and businesses run by black or Spanish maybe?
Yes, it is still to this day a predominantly black community, and it, historically so. You know, it was the part of town historically where black people lived near downtown Durham. Mm-hmm. And that's why it was known as Black Wall Street, that at least the corridor, the Pettigrew Street corridor with Fayetteville, where it used to be lined up with businesses, but now you drive past Pettigrew and, you know, at least that intersection and you don't see that same thing anymore. Yes, it is predominantly black owned businesses. Some of them have been there for a very long time. Some of them are newer, but you can tell the type of forgotten that this community is just by looking around compared to other sides of Durham that are, you know, up and coming, as some would say.
Yeah. Well, you talked to this guy who had a garage, Melvin
yes.
Spike.
Spate, yes.
Spate. And now he's up the street quite a few blocks, is he, from
yes.
that area?
His father owned Spate's service station way back when Haytai was was big, and when Haytai was Black Wall Street, and it was at the intersection of Pettigrew and Fayetteville Streets. And now it was there for about 30 years, and based on what he told me, when the freeway development came in and urban renewal kind of, you know, kicked them out of the area because they were going to redevelop that area, his family moved the business all the way down Fayetteville Street, much further down, really, down the corridor. And so it's a little further away from where Haytai actually is. But, you know, he still feels part of that community. And he says a lot of his clients are still, you know, Haytai members, Haytai community members who remember his father. And, you know, it's still, even though it's not exactly in the Haytai community, his business and his family is still seen as, you know, some of the Haytai members. And he is on the committee, on the board of Haytai Reborn as one of the community members for Haytai Reborn, which is this project I was, I wrote about, led by Henry McCoy, the North Carolina Central professor.
Mm-hmm. So Haytai, what other, is that's an institution specifically for the redevelopment of the area? Or the renewal, or whatever word you want to use.
Right. And I think the key word here that they are trying to emphasize is revitalization without redevelopment, or without redevelopment. So revitalization without removal. So revitalizing an area that will be to the benefit of the community that already lives there, that has had roots there, without, you know, erasing more of that history than it already has been in past years.
What other institutions are involved in this redevelopment prior? I shouldn't use that word. In the renewal of Fayette Place, what other institutions, churches, is there a library there? Is there anything there that focuses on the humanities of the community?
Yes, there is a library that was it was the first kind of brick and mortar official standalone brick and mortar library for black people during the segregation era. And I'm blanking on the name right now, but I believe it's the Stamford Library.
Is that part of the Durham system?
It is now part of the Durham system. It integrated it's the Stanford Warren branch, the Stanford L. Warren branch library. And it is temporarily closed right now, actually, ironically, because it's so old and it has, they're going through some water damage repairs, and they foresee it opening in 2023.
By that area. I saw that building and my wife said, so there's the library. So
yes, that is the library. And that is, you know, it was the hub for kind of, you know, at least what Anita Scott Neville talked to me about. Anita Neville Scott talked to me about was she told me that that used to be kind of the hub for Black literacy, you know, back in the day, and continues to be so because it serves such a predominantly Black community, right? And so that was one of kind of like the pillars of literacy in Haiti that still exists to this day, that are remnants really of what Haiti was before and the historical importance of it for Durham's Black history.
Well, North Carolina Central University is just a few blocks away. Are they involved? Any of their courses or any of the students or any of the faculty involved? It seems like that might be a part of the Fayette Place might be used as classrooms or whatever the university would choose to build there. Have you talked to anybody there at the university?
Well, specifically, like I said, Dr. Henry McCoy, the leader of the Durham Global Equity Project, he is a professor at North Carolina Central, and he has led research on Haiti and Fayette Place, specifically throughout, you know, his time at North Carolina Central. And that's where, you know, he has studied, you know, the history of Haiti and Black Wall Street very deeply and written about it in scholarly articles. So yes, you know, it is part of, and obviously he has his team of, you know, research assistants and whatnot, students and whatnot that are involved in that research with him. So yes, I mean, and intrinsic, the North Carolina Central and Haiti, a lot of people say are intrinsically kind of tied, right? Because they're so close to each other and because of the community that belonged to that area where North Carolina Central is located, historically and predominantly Black, and then North Carolina Central being the HBCU or historically Black college that it was at the time.
You know, it might be since there's quite a few acreage there in Fayette Place, it might be the spot where the university would build a facility, classrooms or something, or some kind of experimental work to kind of be a central spot in that community where people can go and study, learn, or whatever.
Right. And that's part of the vision that Henry McCoy had for Haiti Reborn, one of the projects, one of the proposals, requests for proposals that were rejected by the Durham Housing Authority for Fayette Place. That was North Carolina Central was going to be one of the sponsors, if you will, of that. So, you know, that what would have been that kind of equity hub of Fayette Place under this project that Henry McCoy has, it would have been also kind of a center where there would have been classes or lectures or, you know, conversations, symposiums, conferences of the sort to discuss, you know, Black history, Black equity, racial issues, racial equity, and right there in the heart of Haiti.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is such a it's such a dynamic opportunity that I get carried away thinking about it, but I got to talk to you. And that's the point of this conversation today, is to get acquainted with it, what you've been doing and what you have learned. What do you, did you go to some of these meetings? You had this committee that you mentioned at the end of your newspaper article, the very groups or institutions represented by this committee. Who set this committee up?
So are you talking about the Durham Housing Committee, the authority committee that approved the proposal for Fayette Place?
Yes, the committee. Yeah, you said in the last paragraph this the winner of this proposal. So of this set up by the the Durham Development Partners.
Yes, yes. So I have not attended any meetings. I've mostly been working from home for a lot of my coverage of my time at the NNO. But I do know that the Durham Housing Authority is planning on having more community meetings with, you know, people from the area to get their input on what their proposal is for Fayette Place. As you mentioned, you know, the plan that was approved, there were seven different proposals that were submitted for Fayette Place. And this is just, you know, these are just, this Fayette Place is only one of three different sites that Durham Housing Authority is trying to redevelop. But Fayette Place specifically, they are planning on having, according to Anthony Scott, the CEO, he told me that they are planning on having, you know, community meetings before anything is set in stone for this development project. So this is not, you know, whatever they presented during their board meeting is not a, you know, end all plan. There is more that could be adjusted or added or removed, you know, from the plan, depending on the community's input.
Well, you mentioned in the last paragraph about a winner. You said there's a winner, which includes the Durham Development Partners and Greystone Affordable Development, a Gilbane company partly in Rhode Island. What's Rhode Island doing involved with this Peyton Place?
That's what a lot of people are asking. You know, that's some of the questions that a lot of the community members have and some of the concerns that they've expressed that, you know, that even though they're calling themselves the Durham Community Partners, Gilbane, Greystone, and F7, these are all developers. You know, Gilbane is based out of Rhode Island. Greystone and F7 are both based out of Raleigh. So, you know, they're calling themselves the Durham Community Partners, but people are saying, well, why are they calling themselves? They're not even from here. They don't know the history as well as, you know, some of the partners that maybe Henry McCoy researched and, you know, pulled out to be part of his plan. And, you know, the time that they dedicated to really research Haiti and its history and make it relevant to whatever project they would have created there.
But your article says there was a winner that it mentioned these various outfits. So it looks from what I'm reading that they've decided who's going to run this whole thing.
Well, yes, it is the Gilbane, Greystone, and F7 team. That is the winning team. That they were the group selected. They were the developers selected for the development of Fayette Place.
So they were selected. So they obviously, to be selected, they had to have a pretty complete plan that was submitted to the committee. And did you see that plan? Were you privy to it or not?
Well, Bill, I do not have opinions. I am a journalist, after all. But I will say, you know, for Fayette Place alone, based on the last presentation that I did watch, I don't know if any changes have been made at this point, but for Fayette Place, the Fayette Place property would be a mixed income and mixed use development. And so what that means is that they are looking at having about 774 rental units in that development and 21. Sorry, go ahead.
Say that again.
About 774 rental units for that development.
Wait a minute, 74. In what capacity would these rental units be? Single family homes or projects?
No, yeah. So that's the thing, and that's what a lot of people are concerned about is that these would be rental, you know, apartments. This would not be home ownership. This would be just another kind of affordable housing complex. But the difference being that it's not all public housing and there being some mixed income, meaning that, for example, for folks of very low income would take up about 33.2% based on the plan that I saw. This could change, so don't hold me to it. But the most recent plan that I saw in December when they made the presentation about the winner, it was 33.2% of all units would go to low income. So that means that they would meet that up to 30% average median income, right?
What kind of facilities would they be for these 33%.
Everything is apartments, Bill. So everything would be apartments, and the majority of the units actually would also only be 1 and 2 bedrooms. They will have some studio apartments and some 3-bedroom apartments, but the majority would be 1 and 2 bedroom apartments.
How do they price rentals now? I don't know anything about that. I'm in a rental apartment now, but when they construct these apartments, if they go ahead with this proposal and they construct these apartments, how will they decide the rental for low-income people? Is there a formula for that?
So it's really tricky, and I don't want to get too deep into it because I'm still learning about it myself. But basically, for that low income threshold, it's people who earn up to 30% of the average median income. So they earn only, so if, let's say Durham, I believe the average median income in Durham, let's look that up right now. Average median income in Durham. I believe it's somewhere between 50 or 60. Yes. So it is, for at least 2019, it was about, $60,000. So people who make only 30% of $60,000, that's, you know, those are the folks that would get the priority for that 18% of those units. Right. So that's kind of how they base that. But there are also a lot of HUD guidelines that they have to follow, because the Durham Housing Authority is not a nonprofit. They are technically a local branch of the U.S. Department of, you know, Housing and...
Oh, really?
Yeah. So that's basically the DHA's kind of role. They are a HUD local office, basically. They are kind of like a small branch, and they manage... they manage the resources that are given to them by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development.
So somebody in Washington is going to decide what to charge as a rent in Durham.
That's why I don't want to get too much into it, because I'm not a super big expert, and I don't want to pretend that I am. But all I can say is that they take that. AMI is what they call it, that income level, that income threshold, and then they create smaller thresholds to determine how many units will go to what kind of people with a specific type of income.
Okay, so back to this winning proposal, and I guess the housing is the main issue that would be of concern, because you're talking about people with various incomes that are going to be living in this housing,
right?
But who did the committee run these proposals through? Were there some classes at UNC or at NC Central or Duke that looked at these proposals and made comments, academic comments or spiritual comments? Anybody outside of this committee that had real that had talent that could be effective and could be believed? Was anybody else really brought into this process, or was the committee pretty much functioning privately, which most committees do?
Yeah, to my understanding, what I was told by the Durham Housing Authority was that there was an 11-person selection committee, and that committee consisted of two representatives from the city of Durham, one representative from the county, one community representative who belonged to the community, just a regular community member, one Durham Housing resident, so someone who already lived in a Durham Housing public property. And then you have 6 members of the Durham Housing Authority their own within their organization. So internal people from their own.
Are the members of the Housing Authority of volunteers, or are they salaried people?
I am not sure. I believe they all work. So the names I'm seeing here, for example, is Ed Bigelow. He is the fraud and security manager for DHA. Marcus Clark is the director of resident services. Alicia Curry is the project manager for DHA. Danita Johnson is a director of housing choice voucher program, which is one of the programs that HUD has to fund housing. And then Anthony Snell, the director of development for DHA, and Ralph Staley, who is their chief financial officer. So these are all employees. Yes, these are all employees.
Okay. Have you, I don't know much about the Durham housing, but I've seen some of it, and some of it is seems quite attractive. Have you seen any of the personally, have you personally visited any Durham housing groups, neighborhoods?
I've driven past a few when I'm kind of going through the downtown Durham area. But I have seen the renderings for this project. And, you know, it looks good. I mean, you can't deny it, right? Compared to what Fayette Place looks like right now, it's hard to say that this does not, that it would not look good. And I'm happy to share them with you. These are public, they are public record.
Share them with you, with us.
I have them via email, the slides that were shared with me. And their DHA's information, because they are basically ultimately a government agency, it's public record. They look good, Bill. I can't deny it, right? It's like anything would look great in Fayette Place compared to what it looks like right now.
I just like to drive down there and plant a little flower garden or vegetable garden.
Just right.
There's still
just put something in there.
Soil. So we have this winter. Now, what comes next? What's happening now?
Yeah. So right now, according to what DHA has said, DHA and the Durham Community Partner, so those three developers that we mentioned earlier, they have to negotiate all their agreements, aka money, right? Because yeah, right. That's what it boils down to a lot, most times. They have to figure out, you know, all the logistics, how much money do they have, how much is this going to cost, how much are they going to get paid. But before DHA, you know, makes anything final, according to what they told me, they are going to have some community meetings for public input to really get a sense of, you know, whether or not this is what the community actually wants. And as you may have read, some of the members of the community have actually filed a protest through Hey Ty Reborn, complaining about the proposal, the chosen proposal for Fayette Place. So the Durham Housing Authority told me that they could not provide more comment at the time, but that they would be reviewing and, you know, processing the protest. I don't really know what that means. so we'll find out soon enough, I hope. You know, I am in constant communication with their folks. I email them a lot and, you know, try to ask them questions. So we'll find out.
So there's not going to be any shovels turning dirt there for a while.
Probably not anytime. Probably not in the next year. No.
No. So what can you do as a journalist, since you're part of this team that's been watching this? What will you be doing to see what happens? Will you be invited to meetings of the winners, or will they be held privately? What kind of role will you have, since you've kind of opened the door for questions with your article? What role can you play, or your newspaper play, to see that Fayette Place is being handled for the benefit of the people who are going to be using it, not just for the benefit of the builders, some company in Rhode Island who's going to take a lot of Durham money and enjoy the coastline. So what will you be doing along the way, or don't you know yet?
So I would say that the role of any, you know, media outlet, a journalistic, you know, medium is to hold people in power accountable, right? So we'll be watching, you know, every step of what the Durham Housing Authority will be doing, and what the community asks of the Durham Housing Authority in this process, right? Now that, you know, COVID-19 is kind of, you know, we've seen how the numbers are going down and restrictions are being lifted, you know, with caution, I do plan on attending the meetings, you know, staying in touch with the community members to see when they have meetings, both through DHA or just on their own, right? So just keeping an eye out, right, on everything that's going to be going on, and making sure that the community's voice is heard and taking into account when making all these big decisions.
Well, I'm not a journalist. I don't know how you operate on your full-time basis, but sometimes you have people in various organizations that are your primary contact, and somebody, Joe Smith, is going to say, "Oh, I got something I want to tell. I want to tell Laura about." So he'll call you without you necessarily having to call and ask questions. But people who have you on their list as an important contact, do you have some of those? Would you have that kind of connection with this organization?
Well, I'm very honored to say that, you know, Heytai Reborn, the Heytai Reborn team, they've been great at, you know, staying in touch with me and, you know, keeping me in the loop about any updates on their end. So I would say, yes, you know, I'm very grateful of the relationship I've built with, and the trust that I've built with this, Heytai community, and that they're willing to loop me in whenever something comes up. So yeah, that definitely applies to me. Yes.
Okay. So you have connect. Well, now who's on the team, and who formed the team, and power or strength does this reform team have?
So Heytai Reborn, like I mentioned earlier, is led by Dr. Henry McCoy, but there are numerous other people. You know, he kind of started it, but okay. It was really, it really is the members of the Heytai community, whether they are elders or they are current members. They are really the ones driving the conversation with Heytai Reborn, which is why I believe so many people are very fond of Henry McCoy. He is not from Durham. And, you know, he's not from Durham. He's not from Heytai, but he loves that community like he is from there. And I think that the community, the Heytai community members, see that and understand that and reciprocate that kind of attention that he gives their community. So, yeah, I would say that they are, you know, there's like you said, Mr. Melvin Spite, and then Miss Anita Scott Neville. And then there's also Miss Hilda Smith, another Heytai elder. So a lot of these people have lived in that community, whether present or past, for many, many years, and still want to be active in the decisions that are made in Heytai and Fayette Place for that same reason.
Okay, well, I need to tell our listeners that you're listening to WCOM, this is your voice in the community. WCOM is supported by people in the community who are underwriters of our shows. And this show is one of many. We have musical shows. We have a few other talk shows. And we broadcast 24 hours a day. Our shows can be heard worldwide. And it's easy to listen to WCOM no matter where you are. And we'll continue this conversation for another few more minutes, because it's almost our hour is almost completed. But I want to make sure that I learned today what I can learn from this very well-spoken journalist. And I'm so impressed with this whole situation, because this looks to me as an explosive image of how an area can be redeveloped for the benefit of those people who are going to use the area and live there. And so many of these kind of redevelopment, well, this was a redevelopment when it started, this whole thing, when they started tearing down these buildings and building the highway, this was called redevelopment. And I don't think they use that word anymore because it sounds to me like redevelopment means disaster.
Right. And to the people in this community, it does. You know, every time I've spoken to them, they are just very, you know, mistrustful. They don't trust that good will be done by them when anything is happening in their community, unless they have a direct say in what is going to happen. Because what happened back when during the development of the Durham Freeway was that, you know, a lot of these people were promised that they would be able to come back into Haiti and that they would be, you know, given land and homes and business property, retail space, once again, once the freeway was built. And that did not happen, right? So some of the controversy that you were mentioning earlier at the beginning of the show, you were talking about how, you know, there was controversy. And there was, because there were some people in that same community, in the Haiti community, who supported and voted for the development of the Durham Freeway. But other people were skeptical and kind of foresaw, if you will, what was going to happen, the future of Haiti and Black Wall Street and its imminent collapse. I would say that it's reasonable, you know, if it's pretty reasonable considering the history of Haiti, that these people in this community are so fearful of what could come next and what could be taken from them. Even though it seems to some that they have nothing left, you know, because like you said, Bill, when you drive past there, there's not much there. But, you know, it's just the fear that it'll be even more lost and that it will no longer be theirs. And that, you know, maybe gentrification will be the next chapter in their story. And they don't want that. They want Haiti to stay theirs and to still be a part of their history and for the history of Haiti to still continue and live on.
Well, you had just started at the NNO before you got this assignment. When you got this assignment, weren't you kind of alarmed yourself, saying this is a huge project? How can I take this project on by myself?
I have to shout out my editor. He knows a lot about the history of Haiti. He was the former, managing editor for the Herald Sun, when it was still a brick and mortar in Durham. So I'm very grateful that he was very intent and very helpful in explaining, you know, and giving me the time and space to learn about Haiti and Fayette Place. You know, I spent the first time I ever met Henry McCoy in person, we talked for maybe 2 hours. Did I use that full interview? No. But it did help inform my writing, right? It helped inform my journalism. And I think that that's all a young journalist can ask for when they're, you know, still finding their voice and their way in the business. And so I'm very grateful, like I said earlier, that I stumbled upon this beautiful yet tragic, if you will, also all at the same time, story of Haiti and what it could become, what it is right now and what it was and how that all ties in together. Right. Into who the people are today and what they want and what they believe in.
What other kind of journalism activities have you done beside Haiti here or elsewhere?
So I've been able to do some coverage of, you know, the arrival of Afghans last summer as well. It was a busy summer, Bill. we had, you know, the arrival of Afghan newcomers after the Taliban took over Kabul. Yes. So I spoke to some local Afghans who resettled in the area about, you know, their thoughts and their fears because they still have family members over there, right?
Tell me a little bit about this, the Afghan resettlement. So what's going on in this, in your journalistic world that you represent, the NNO?
Right. It's not over. It's still happening, and it's probably even busier now than it was the first few months when, you know, we saw all the headlines. We're not seeing a lot of the headlines right now, but I've been in communication with all of the agencies locally. It's such a sensitive topic, right? These people are likely high risk of being targeted still by the Taliban. So they're fearful of saying anything and talking about their experiences and what they faced and what they went through, right? Out of fear of retaliation, even though they're in the United States now. But anyway, these resettlement efforts are still happening. I believe that the last group of based on something I read from the State Department recently, the last group of Afghans that have been in military bases across the country, they are now finally leaving those military bases where, you know, they were checking them, you know, they were checking all they were getting background checked basically and getting all their paperwork done for immigration reasons and getting all their vaccines, you know, COVID checks and whatnot, health checks. All this stuff was happening in those military bases. And now once they're all done with that and they're cleared to go, then the resettlement agencies help them arrive in our community. So North Carolina has about, I believe, six main cities where Afghans were going to arrive: Raleigh, Durham, New Bern, Asheville, Greensboro. And I'm missing one, but hold me to that.
What? You mentioned that. Repeat that again.
Yes. So the ones that I can think of off the top of my head are Charlotte, Asheville, yeah, Raleigh, Durham, New Bern, and I'm missing one. Missing one city. Greensboro. Did I mention Greensboro? Greensboro. Yeah. Yes. The Greensboro, Winston-Salem, and High Point area is another one.
So what's happening is, so the people are going to be settled in these regions you're mentioning?
A lot of them have already settled, you know. A lot of them have already been housed, and there's a lot of temporary housing efforts happening in the area to help them find temporary housing until they can find a job, and, you know, they can provide a stipend and a proof of income and find a permanent place to live.
Are these mostly families or individuals?
Mostly families. No, mostly families, Bill. Yeah, it's really you know, heartbreaking that these families just kind of, you know, get here with nothing. You know, they came here with nothing. They just got on that plane with their eyes closed, hands tied, and just hope for the best when they got on those planes to get here to the U.S. for safety.
So when they're being resettled in these five regions or cities, there must be somebody or some organization in each of these places that's finding them housing, finding them clothing, finding them jobs, I guess. I mean, they don't want to just be living on gift money. They want to be part of the environment.
Right. And that those efforts are happening through all of the, there are lots of, there are, I believe all five of the government sponsors resettlement agencies are here in North Carolina. And then there are all a lot of little smaller ones that are kind of support them in their efforts as well.
So will you be prepared some week down the road to do a radio show on resettling these Afghan families?
I'd love to if you'd have me.
Okay, well, that's good. Well, I see our time is about up because my guard Felix is looking through the screen at us, and we'll have to pretty soon say goodbye. So next week, I think we'll just actually repeat the show, not with you live, but just the recording of today's show, because this is so much interesting to me. And I want to make sure that more people in the area hear about what is going on and what you have learned. And so maybe down the road, we'll even talk about this again. It sounds to me like the housing or the Fayette Place construction work isn't going to start too soon.
Correct. Yeah, there's no definite plan on when exactly it'll start and when it'll end.
But you will be reporting on this as it goes along, though.
Absolutely. So anyone who would like to follow along, you know, keep in touch. And I'm very accessible. I share my number and my email, and I'm happy to answer any questions if anyone has them.
Well, thanks again for coming with us today and allowing me to repeat our conversation next week without the usual pay that you should be getting. So that's it for tonight or for this afternoon or whenever we're talking. Here we are in Carrboro on a Monday night. So we'll see you again, and thanks so much for being part of Time Out. Thank you.